Thank you. It's very exciting to be here. I think the best way to invest in science is to educate students and teachers. So I think it's a great opportunity. As Sam said, I'm also teaching this class called Frontiers of Science, which has a very different goal as this summer program. So I'm hoping to learn something from this one too. So as you see from the title, I'm going to talk about black holes, but hopefully from a different perspective than what you guys have encountered before. I'm going to, hoping for an interactive discussion, so if you guys have any questions, please feel free to stop me anytime and ask about anything. We're going to cover a lot of topics, so there may be questions. So just a brief outline. I'm going to talk very briefly about black holes. I'm sure, has anybody not heard of black holes before? Okay, that's good. So I'm going to very briefly talk about black holes. Also, how black holes are born. This may be less clear for many cases. Also, how do we know about them in the first place? Again, they are dark, they're far away. How do we know about them? And also, more importantly, what can we learn from black holes? How can we use them to understand the universe? So let's start with black holes themselves. So this is the solar system, let's say the sun and the Earth. Now, the sun is too small to ever become a black hole. It's never going to become one. But let's say we have a magic wand and we make the sun a black hole all of a sudden. Just to wake up a little bit, what do you guys think would happen to the Earth if the sun would suddenly become a black hole? Any suggestion?
Earth would be sucked right in.
Sorry.
Wouldn't X-rays have like a major effect?
X-rays, there could be, you mean X-rays from the black hole?
Like emanating from the heat that's created around the arcs.
Good point. It depends on what kind of magic wand we use. Very good. Anything else? Yes. Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. Anything else, Chris? That's what you... So again, it depends on the magic wand. But if we just suddenly made the sun a black hole, nothing really would happen. Well, things would go dark, things would go cold right away. But besides that, just the gravitational effect of this black hole would be exactly the same as the sun. There wouldn't be any effect otherwise that we would feel. If it was at night, we were somewhere here, we wouldn't feel anything. There wouldn't be any difference at all. So the point is black holes will not really have any strange effects, any peculiar effects, as far as we are far away from them, as we don't approach them. The interesting stuff that makes black holes a special object in the universe is things that happen once we get really close. So when somebody gets really close to a black hole, a lot of things change. Well, time changes, time slows down as we get really close. Distances, lengths change. We get much shorter as we get closer. And of course, masses, things become much heavier. There's also a point of no return, as you guys know. If we get close enough, we're never going to be able to come back. So most of the experiments we can do ourselves with black holes, we're never going to be able to tell anybody else what we found. So that's not really the way to go, and that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about something else, which is using black holes in a safe way when we try to learn from them without getting really close, without falling into them, and to use them to learn something about the universe in general. So next topic is, how are black holes born? How can we create black holes? So just to start off with what we can think of. So first of all, we need to have a lot of mass, and we have to squeeze it in to a very tiny volume. Okay, so these are heavy objects. And once we squeeze something together, it will become a black hole. Okay, the question is, we don't have a magic wand for this case. How can we potentially, or how can the universe potentially squeeze enough mass together to create a black hole? What kind of effects, or what kind of situations can result in enough mass in a small enough volume? How would you guys think this could happen? Yes?
Basically, stars are like constantly exploding nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. So
very good, very good. So you mentioned a lot of very good things, and that's my next slide, actually. So again, the first important point is, what's going to pull things together? Okay, we can't squeeze things together with a magic wand. What we're going to have to do, we're going to have gravity pull things close enough together. As I'm standing here, the only major force acting on me is gravity. Gravity is pulling me towards the Earth. There's no other forces that pull me enough. And the same thing is going to be true for these masses. You can't have other forces but gravity pulling things to the very center and forming the black hole. Okay? So we have to rely on gravity. And again, we have to have enough mass together to have a strong enough gravitational field that's going to squeeze things enough. So that's the first important point. And second, which is a great example, a massive star. If we have a big enough star, much bigger than the sun, let's say 30 times bigger than the sun, roughly, this will have enough mass to eventually form a black hole. The reason it doesn't do it automatically, or the reason the stars, all the stars, the sun included, are as big as they are, is because of this constant, as you mentioned, constant fusion, constant thermonuclear bomb, basically, being active in the very center of these stars. Okay, so this thermonuclear bomb that's constantly active will provide the temperature and the pressure that, that pushes things out and balances gravity. So it doesn't let gravity pull things in. Once we have a low enough pressure, let's say we run out of fuel, for example, or if the center becomes some different kind of material that doesn't go through fusion anymore, we're not going to have anything that balances gravity. We're not going to have this pressure, and the whole thing, the center of the star, will collapse into a black hole, potentially, again, depending on the mass of the star. So that's the first scenario when, again, we start off with enough mass to form a black hole. Now, this happens with big enough stars, but there are many, many other, actually, most stars will not have enough mass to form a black hole. Is there any other way how we can create a black hole if we don't start off with enough mass? Can you guys think of anything else? Yes. Very good. That's going to be my next slide. So let me wait with that for a second, because there's a third way that is useful to create a black hole. Any other idea? Again, we had a big enough star. We had two things smashing together. Is there any other way how to make a black hole? Very good. Very good. Something that's smaller, that starts off smaller, can become more massive. And the way to do that, for example, is to have a companion star, for example, that feeds something that will eventually become a black hole. Very good. So we don't need to smash two things together. We don't have to have two very massive things. We can have one smaller thing, let's say a neutron star that you mentioned, and it can take some mass, accrete some mass from some companion star. As you guys may know, stars are sort of like people. They don't want to be themselves. Most stars have a companion, okay? And so many, many stars, when their companion grows big enough, they can accrete some mass from it and eventually become black holes. So that's the second way. And the third possibility that you mentioned before is smashing two things together. This can be, for example, two neutron stars. But basically, if you take two masses that, if they are combined, they have enough mass to collapse into a black hole, this is going to happen. And these two things, two stars, it could be white dwarfs, it could be neutron stars, can smash together and form a black hole. Okay, so there are many different ways to form these black holes. Now, there is a completely different type of black hole out there. So all the black holes, the type of bursts we mentioned so far, give birth to solar mass, so-called solar mass black holes, which have the mass a few times of the sun. So they're not that heavy in astronomical standards, but they're much, much heavier black holes out there. Basically, in the center of most galaxies, there is a ginormous black hole called the supermassive black hole, including the center of the Milky Way. These can be millions or billions of times heavier than our sun. So they're much, much, much heavier than what we typically encounter, what we typically think of as black holes that are born all over the place. So this is a completely different category. And they're actually very interesting because there seems to be a very close connection between the galaxies themselves and these supermassive black holes, their masses, their how the galaxies behave, basically, is very closely connected to this central black hole. So they are thought to be extremely important for the formation and the evolution of the galaxies. Yes?
So I may be wrong here, but a black hole has a singular
supposedly, yes.
Supposedly. So if that's a regular black hole, has a singularity of supermassive, one has a super singularity?
Very, very interesting point. So there are two important things. There is supposed to be a singularity in the center of each black hole. However, we don't really know because we don't see the singularity. What we see for any black hole, I don't have a good picture here, but the point is, what we see for a black hole, or what we can experience, is the so-called event horizon, which is the point of no return. We don't know what's happening within that horizon. We only know what's happening on the surface or outside, basically. We think that there is a singularity in the center because gravity should be pulling everything to the very center of these objects. And if with the understanding of physics we have right now, everything should be in a very small, basically infinitesimally small volume in the very center. We expect that if we understand better what's happening within black holes, then there should be a size associated to the singularity. But given just general relativity, or what we know, again, classically, it's going to be a singularity. And the size, which is zero, will not depend on the mass. However, the event horizon will depend largely on the mass itself. So basically, how big this point of no return is will be proportional to the mass. So if you take two black holes that have the masses of the sun and you just smash them together, you're going to get a black hole that's twice as big in radius. So its volume is going to be much, much bigger, actually. I was going to mention this later, but actually one interesting consequence of this is that even though we can think of black holes as the densest things in the universe, it's extremely dense in some sense. If we have a big enough black hole, if you take these black holes in the centers, which are, let's say, billions of times heavier than the sun, then taking this even horizon, the black hole itself is lighter than air. It's a very, very sparse object, even though it's a huge mass, because things go linearly with mass. It's going to be this humongous volume. So the whole thing, as is going to be extremely light compared to things that we know here. OK, so there are two different answers to this. But again, when we think of black holes, we usually don't think of the singularity that much, because again, that's something we can't really measure. We think of the surface area. And interesting things can happen to the surface itself, not to the singularity. At least we don't know. If you fall in, actually, you won't know either, because you can't look down in the black hole. You can look up. So you're never going to see the singularity, unfortunately, even if you're inside. So that's harder to test.
Could you explain what a singularity is?
Again, one way to think of it is that everything is just going to be squeezed in to an infinitesimally small volume. The problem with this is this picture does not include quantum mechanics, or we know of quantum mechanics. And that's one of the biggest open questions of physics or astrophysics right now, how to combine these two otherwise extremely distinct theories of nature. So until we have an understanding of this combination, we're not really going to know how these singularities actually behave. But we suspect that it's not going to be an infinitesimally small thing, because there is no such thing in nature as zero. There may be a connection. It may be a very similar singularity than what we talk about when we talk about black holes. Exactly. So there's a
thought that black holes can drain through the singularity into yet another dimension.
I don't know any idea that has not been suggested regarding Big Bang. So this is definitely something that people think of. And in fact, when you describe what happens, or when some people try to describe what's happening within a black hole, they use the same mathematics what you use for describing the Big Bang itself. So there's a lot of connections, both mathematically and supposedly physically. But again, unfortunately, we're not going to have a grasp on what happens at the very center until we can combine quantum mechanics and gravity, or general relativity. So until then, it's a little bit fuzzy. But again, it's a very good point. There could be a connection. There could be a very close connection between black holes and the Big Bang. Very interesting. Getting back to supermassive black holes, so one interesting thing, again, we have these tiny little things, and we have these humongous monsters in the centers of galaxies. And we don't 100% understand how these things are formed, because again, as I'll mention in a second, we don't see anything between the small ones and these big black holes. What we suspect is that these things could be formed through mergers and acquisitions. These things can merge with other, for example, galaxies merge. We know galaxies merge. We know smaller parts of galaxies can come together. Things can fall into this massive black hole. So we suspect that this may have grown over time, step by step. One interesting question about this, though, again, we have these so-called solar mass black holes, which are born the way we just described, and they're going to have the mass a few times the mass of the sun, or we're going to have these so-called supermassive black holes that are much, much heavier, millions or billions of times heavier than the sun. But for some reason, we don't see anything between, which is not typical in physics. Usually, if we see two extremes, we're going to see a continuous spectrum, so-called, between the two ends. We should be seeing stuff in the very middle, these so-called intermediate mass black holes, but we don't see them as of now. I want to emphasize it may not be that they are not out there. It may be simply that we have no way to observe these. We can observe these because we see black holes born, as I'll mention in a second. We can see these because they're in the centers of galaxies, and they're also visible. But these things in the center may be much harder to confirm that they're actually there. So how do we know about black holes? So we saw how they're born. We saw what they are. But how do we know about them? Again, without falling in, we're not talking about what happens if you get really close. So the first way to get to know something about black holes or to see them is by learning from others' mistakes. What I mean is, again, as we described, we don't need to fall into a black hole to see it. We can wait for somebody else or something else to fall in, and we can see this particularly. So for example, if you take this accretion from, let's say, another star, but it could be also the other examples, how black holes are born, we can observe this matter accreting into the black hole. What happens is these things get extremely hot as it's being squeezed towards the black hole, as it's getting closer, and it's going to, well, not scream, but it's going to radiate because of this temperature that we can observe. It can also launch these so-called jets that we can observe. So this matter will have a signature that we can see from far, far away. And again, we don't need to get close. We can just observe other things getting close. There's another way, though, because this first way needs something to fall in the black hole. But there are ways to see them, supposedly, even without any interaction with matter that's falling in the black hole. And this is through these things called waves, gravitational waves. Basically, what you can think of is these ripples in space and time, or space-time, if you will, which may sound like a strange concept. But basically, again, according to general relativity, space is something that's curved by gravity. So if there is a periodic curvature that can propagate in space or in time the same way as waves propagate on the surface of some water. If you drop in something in water, the waves are going to propagate, and we can see them at the side of the lake, for example. And the same thing happens with gravity. If something moves really quickly, we can't drop in something to space. But if we move something that's very heavy very quickly, for example, if two black holes or two heavy objects like neutron stars rotate around each other, they're going to produce these waves that are going to come out, and we can hopefully observe them far away. Again, these are so-called gravitational waves. Let me just spend 2 minutes on these specifically. So the problem with gravitational waves, again, let me start with that we haven't detected these so far. They were predicted by Einstein roughly 100 years ago, but we have not detected these directly. The reason is that, electric force in general is an extremely strong force. We can take some things really close and we feel, for example, magnets pulling each other. But gravity itself is an extremely small, extremely weak force. The Earth is this humongous thing, and it's not that strong force that applies on us, for example. So if you take typical waves, gravitational waves, then the actual size of the wave, or if you will, the actual change in distances, is going to be this extremely small number. So it means that what you can think here is a distance between two objects will change with this fraction, which is 10 to the minus 21. It's a tiny number. That's the point here. Just to put it in context, if you take the Milky Way, if you take the size of the Milky Way, if this wave of gravitation is coming by, the typical change it's going to have over the size of the Milky Way is going to be the diameter of this soccer ball. It's very tiny. So it's not easy to detect these things. Also, just to complicate things, it's not going to be an actual wave the way we think of it. It's not just pulling things together. It's going to have this strange shape. It's going to stretch in one direction and compress in the other direction, and then vice versa. So it's going to be this very peculiar change in distances and space in general. Okay, so the point here is it's not surprising that we haven't detected this thing so far. However, we are working towards doing this. And this is a detector in Hanford, Washington, that is meant to detect these things. So again, we need to detect things. We can detect things in two directions. We need to detect the stretch and the compression at the same time. And that's what these detectors are doing. This is a 4 kilometers long arm in both directions. Yes?
Why is it a two-dimensional stretch either direction and not three-dimensional?
Very good question. Gravitational waves are the so-called transverse waves. So if you propagate in one direction, the stretch and pull will only be perpendicular to the direction of propagation. So if the wave is going towards you from me, then it's only going to be in these two directions. There are different waves in nature. There's a compression wave. Sound is a compression wave. If it's going towards you from me, it's going to compress things in this direction. And there's these transverse waves that compress and stretch things in the perpendicular direction. So it's, in this sense, it's very similar to light, to photons, which also stretch things perpendicular to the direction of propagation. So the point is, these detectors are meant to detect these gravitational waves. And again, because it's a transverse wave, if it's coming from the top, then this detector is going to be the most sensitive. Well, if the wave is coming from this plane for some reason, then it's not going to detect anything for the same reason. Just to show you another nice picture, this is another detector of the exact same size, 4 kilometers in Louisiana. These are the two US detectors we're trying to use to measure to detect these gravitational waves. This measurement? The idea is that, again, you're trying to measure the stretch or compression of space itself. So what you need to do, you need to measure the change in distances extremely precisely. So what happens is, you have this long arm, this long detector, and you're going to try to measure the change in distance between these two ends of the detector. What you end up doing, you send a laser beam from the center to the very end that comes back eventually. And you're going to try to measure how the phase of the laser that's coming back to you changes as it goes back and forth between these two ends many, many times. And if a gravitational wave comes by and space gets distorted, this distance slightly changes. Again, it's a very, very tiny change, and you can measure that by the change in the phase of the laser beam that's coming back to you. Technically, how you do that, you send out two laser beams in the two directions, and you compare their phases, just to make things a little simpler. Okay, so it's called interferometry. You use these laser beams and their phases to measure distances to this extremely high precision. Again, just to put the precision in context, I showed you this example of the Milky Way and a soccer ball. But if you take this distance, which is 4 kilometers, with this detector, we need to measure distances that are a small fraction of the size of a hydrogen atom. Okay, so you measure something that's much, much smaller than any of the elements that build this detector, protons. Okay, so it's a very, very difficult measurement. That's why it's not an easy one, and it's been going on for a long time. But luckily, and that's hopefully going to be a time when you hear much more about this. In the next few years, we finish the next generation of these detectors, and we're hoping for the first detection of these gravitational waves, again, based on our understanding of when black holes are born or when things where things happen that we can observe. So stay tuned. Again, next 2 years, you'll hear more about this. Yes? Exactly. So synchrotrons are very different because you can do a lot of more useful stuff, with them. This is specifically for gravitational waves. Exactly. So it's something that's really pushing the limits of what we can see. Synchrotrons have been around for a long time, and that's a known technology. Everybody can build a synchrotron. If you come to the physics building here, there used to be a synchrotron. It was too old, so we actually removed it, but it's something that's been around for a long time. This is something that's, again, never been detected, and even though it's an expensive experiment, this is something that's going to hopefully push our limits of understanding more than synchrotrons. But again, and the thing is, when you started off with synchrotrons, first that was also used only for detecting, let's say, different particles. You never know what's, you know, what we're going to detect after our first observation of astrophysical sources. We'll see. But good question. It's always important to look forward. Yes?
So in relationship to this, like, how do you kind of do that? And then the Higgs boson particle in relation to this, like, how do you relate those two to kind of come up with some type of theory on this?
So, okay, there are many different answers to this question. The first answer is that the discovery of the Higgs boson, to some extent, was a disappointment. And the reason is that it's been what people have known for decades.
Yeah.
There was no surprises. So technically, the discovery, or what we think of the Higgs boson now, it's not 100% confirmed, but let's assume it is. It is exactly what we thought of the so-called standard model, which is our understanding of quantum mechanics and related stuff, particle physics now. Now, we know that there are limitations of this theory. We know that it's not a complete understanding. And one of the reasons we know this is that it makes no sense together with gravity. It doesn't. We can't combine the standard model with general relativity or our understanding of gravity. So in this sense, we need to extend this model to some direction. The discovery of the Higgs boson by itself did not add to this extension because, again, it just confirmed what we knew already of standard model particles. This experiment is going to be used for a bunch of things, but one of the things is to try to understand if there's any deviation from general relativity as we understand it now, which may or may not, again, it's hard to say at this point, add to our understanding of how general relativity or whatever is in the place of it can be combined with the standard model. They should be related, exactly. So we are hoping for a model that combines all these different models, all these different forces in nature. But again, the Higgs boson, as we discovered it, did not add to our understanding. We didn't learn much more than what we knew before. Yes?
I know these detectors have been running for a number of years at least. So are they considered like failures at this point? What would the next generation look like? Or are they still,
yes.
Still up and running, right?
Yes, very good question. So this is the first generation of detectors, and this is the second generation of detectors. There's no change in the outside, okay? The whole thing will look exactly, it does look exactly the same. There's no change in what you see here. What changed is within this box, okay? That's all that changed, and basically within those little places too. Now, the first generation, the way we try to phrase it is it was an opportunistic measurement, which means that we could have seen something, but there was no guarantee. With the second generation so-called advanced detectors that we're building, and again, as I put this slide here, we're going to finish in 2 years. We're hoping to have for detection, and it's not just opportunistic. We know, and I'll mention some sources, we know exactly what to expect. We know objects out there that will emit gravitational waves that are strong enough for us to detect with these advanced detectors. Okay, so. I would say that the fact that we didn't see anything before was sad, but completely normal. And this detection is much more likely. And I'll be extremely sad, of course, if we didn't. But I see no reason why we wouldn't. So our understanding of the universe is such that we should see a lot of things with these advanced detectors. I don't know if that answered the question. No failure so far. In 4 years, if there's nothing, then it's going to be a failure. Yes?
I remember Star Trek has talk of wormholes as well as black holes. There's still talk of wormholes, or has that been thrown out?
So there's a famous book by Kip Thorne. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's one of the famous physicists who, first of all, he also was starting this detection with a few others. He has a book called Black Holes, Wormholes, and something else, neutron stars. I forgot the title. The point is, he was approached by Carl Sagan, who was a popular scientist and an actual scientist too. And he wanted to write a book that contained something about wormholes, but he wanted to be as scientifically accurate as possible. And he asked Kip Thorne to calculate what the chances are, or if it's possible at all. And what Kip Thorne found, at least according to the book, was that mathematically, these things are possible. But if you formed a wormhole, it wouldn't be so-called stable, which means that it would collapse right away by itself. So it's like if I throw a glass away, it can break to little pieces on the floor. And there is a chance that it's going to jump back on the table and get together. The chances is very small. And the same thing is true for wormholes. There's our current understanding is that there's no chance that it's going to be open for a while. But again, that's according to Kip Thorne. There's no scientific discussion currently of wormholes. I'm not the judge of whether that's good or not. OK, so again, stay tuned 2 years, detector. And we're going to tweak the detector a little bit. And 3-4 years, if you don't hear from us, then it's very sad. But hopefully you will. So let's jump to some different topic, which is very much related to this, which is what we can actually detect these things. So I want to go back to the 1960s for the example. How many of you have heard of these things called gamma ray bursts? 1, 2, that's not bad, OK, 3. OK, so gamma ray bursts. But in the 60s, we had no idea of these things. What we had ideas about is how to make these bombs. And basically, in 1963, there was a treaty between the US and the USSR banning the regular explosions of these bombs, or at least containing how many explosions people can have per year. Unrelated to what I'm going to talk about, but there is an extremely interesting video, I put the link here, on when explosions happened, by which countries, how big they were, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very interesting historical video, if you guys have a chance. But anyway, so there were these explosions, and again, the US and the USSR had a treaty to limit the number of explosions. But you had to check for whether different countries comply with this treaty. So the US designed and basically launched these satellites called the Velos satellites that were meant to observe whether the Soviets comply with this treaty and basically detect any nuclear explosion out there on Earth. The way they did that was through detecting these things called gamma rays. Basically, when a nuclear explosion happens, even if it's fission, or either if it's fission or fusion, there are extremely energetic photons emitted by the nuclear processes, again, both ways. These are called gamma rays, which, again, many, many times more energetic than photons that we usually encounter, visible photons. And these photons are emitted by these explosions in large quantities. And this satellite was able to detect these from anywhere on Earth, basically. But what turned out an interesting consequence of this mission, that the satellite didn't just detect the actual nuclear bombs, nuclear explosions on Earth, but it also detected this weird gamma ray bursts, as they call them, these gamma ray explosions from outer space, from directions that are unrelated to the Earth, not from the atmosphere, from completely different directions. And well, they detected this in the 60s, but they published a scientific article on this roughly 10 years later because of different classifications. And basically, they claim that they have no idea what these things are. It couldn't be human-made. It couldn't be something that was produced on Earth. It had to be some burst, some gamma ray burst of cosmic origin that they have no idea about. And this is something that has been a quest of astrophysics to understand as much as possible what these things were. So let's see what we can know about the origin of these things, just from what they could first or later detect about these things. So let's talk about the strength of how we can measure, how we can identify the strength of these objects. What kind of what size of objects can produce these things? Again, just based on observations, and what can be the potential source? Again, these are very short-lived bursts of gamma rays, so there has to be a source that was there before that produced these events at some point. So about the strength. What we see, if we look at these different bursts of gamma rays, is that they come from all over the space, all over the sky, which basically means that if you look at the Milky Way, which is down here, the plane of the Milky Way, again, we are in the plane of the Milky Way. So if you see something in this plane, that means that it usually is from the Milky Way itself. It's from our galaxy, so it's not extragalactic. But the fact that we see things from all over the space, all over the place, means that these things have to be extragalactic. They have to come from somewhere much farther, from a galaxy far, far away, basically, not from our galaxy. Which means that because we measure the strength of these sources, we measure how much gamma rays come from these different sources, the fact that they're extragalactic means that they have to be extremely energetic, okay, much more energetic than what a nuclear bomb could produce here on Earth, and not something that a star could produce here in the Milky Way. Okay, so that we know from this observation that these are extremely energetic processes. Now, about the size, it's harder because, you know, these things are extremely far, especially if it's extragalactic, but even if it was galactic, sizes are extremely hard to measure in astrophysics because of the large distances. There's no resolution that we can use to measure the size of anything, basically. What we could do, however, for this specific case, we can look at the temporal structure, how this burst of gamma ray changes with time, how the strength of this burst varies with time, and we saw that there is a very, very fast variation. This strength of the emission changes extremely rapidly, basically a small fraction of a second. It can be a millisecond in some cases. Very, very fast. What this means in this case in astrophysics, if we have something very quick here on Earth, that doesn't mean anything. But astrophysically, the fact that some object changes with this frequency means that it has to be extremely tiny. Basically, any object, I just put the Earth here, but any object astrophysically cannot change faster as a whole than how much time it takes for light to get from one end to the other. Okay, information has to proceed within the object. And again, this sets a minimum time for how fast these things can change. Okay, so if light couldn't travel from here to here, then there's no way any other information went from here to here, so the whole object cannot change faster than this time. So if you look at the change, the variation, how rapid this variation is, and we look at how big objects light could traverse over this time period, we find that this has to be an extremely small object. Basically, it has to be significantly smaller than the Earth. Now, the Earth is very big here, but astrophysically, it's a very tiny object. So this basically excludes almost everything out there. Okay, a star, a white dwarf, which is the same size as the star, anything else basically is much, much bigger than our Earth. So everything that's that big could not produce this signal. It had to be an extremely tiny object. I wonder if you guys have any idea what that is. So how about the sources? How do we know what kind of processes or what kind of astrophysical objects could result in the emission of these gamma rays? Now, what happened was, at least with some of these gamma ray bursts, we found an accompanying supernova explosion. Have you guys heard of supernovae? You have or you haven't?
Yes.
You have, okay. So a supernova is an explosion of a massive star. So the fact that we saw this in coincidence with a gamma ray burst means that the origin of at least these gamma ray bursts must have been the explosion of a massive star. Okay, so that explains everything for these ones, but not for all of them. There are some objects for which the shorter gamma ray bursts, actually, for which we didn't see anything like that. We don't see any counterpart that could accompany. So we don't know just from this information what those things are. So again, we know that some gamma ray bursts come from the explosion of massive stars, but for other ones, there has to be a completely different source of origin. Okay, so if we put these things together, it turns out, again, we need a very tiny object. So the most likely candidate for these is a black hole that accretes matter the way we just described a second ago. When this accretion happens, the black hole will emit this this jet of plasma of charged little particles that will emit, that will produce these very, very energetic gamma rays that we detect here on Earth. Okay, so this is the phenomenon that must be responsible for these gamma ray bursts, as we deducted from the different information we just mentioned. And again, it seems that this system, this black hole and accretion, this system can come from the explosion of a massive star. Again, the star explodes, its center collapses into a black hole, and the rest of the star that remains after the black hole is formed falls back onto the black hole and forms an accretion disk that will create the jet that we observe. Okay, but for the other sources that is not massive stars, things are a little more complicated. It turns out, actually, let me just mention this. It turns out we didn't see any other counterpart that could hint on what these things are. But what we suspect is that it's the merger of two objects, like two neutron stars, for example. That's what we suspect behind it. But again, we didn't have any observational evidence to show that. And that's why the gravitational wave detectors are going to be extremely useful, for example, to finding this progenitor of these sources. Because if two neutron stars, let's say, merge and form this gamma ray burst, then we're going to see the gravitational waves coming out from these sources before this jet is emitted and before you see the gamma ray burst. So this is still an ongoing effort astrophysically to find this other candidate. But otherwise, the picture is pretty much solved. Yes?
Quick on that last slide, you had the small size of the object based on the gamma ray variation. Does that apply to the massive stars as a source too, or do the massive stars give a different signal than this?
The massive stars could not give this signal because they are much, much bigger, right?
So they just look about much more consistent.
Exactly. So if you look at a supernova explosion, that basically is an explosion of a massive star. That's going to go on for hours and hours, and there's no faster variation within that. It's going to be, and again, this is seconds, right? It's going to go on for, I don't know if it's milliseconds or seconds, but it's going to go on for hours or maybe days.
This is the case where you have a very small object.
Exactly. This has to be very, very small. The massive star explosion that we see before this event happens will go on for much longer, sometimes days, with afterglow emission, et cetera. So this is peculiar. Most things that you see astrophysically will be much slower events. Again, even like a day is very short astrophysically. Usually, you may talk about weeks or years or millions of years. There was another question, or okay. So this is going to be much longer. Okay, so again, this is the likely origin of these things, as we deducted. Now, that's all fine, and we can detect these black holes, and we can see them with these different methods. But what is it good for? What can we learn just from detecting these things? So the point is, as we mentioned, we can use these black holes as, let me just put it here, cosmic laboratories, and we can explore, and I'll elaborate on this, nature at its extremes. Many, or if not most, of scientific discoveries, especially in physics, comes from studying the extremes. We don't necessarily learn from the average. We always want to learn about the extreme situations. That gives us something that we don't know otherwise. From average measurements. So studying the extremes is always a good way to go to discover completely new things that we haven't known before. That's what the particle accelerators do. They accelerate particles to extremely high energies, and they try to study what happens at this extreme energies that should be completely different from what we learn from smaller energies in general. Okay, so the same thing happens here. The picture is just an illustration, but basically this is a detector at the South Pole that's observing things that are coming from black holes and their surroundings. These are called neutrinos, which are tiny neutral particles. Yes?
How do you read through the extremes versus the anomalies?
Extremes versus anomalies. It's a very good question. It's a very good question. There's always anomalous things everywhere. How you can, and it may not be always the case, but how you can usually talk about extremes or see what happens in an extreme situation is you have some measure of where you are in energy, in time, as we saw, in size. There's always some measure of if you're at the extreme that you haven't explored before or not. So anomalies you can observe in many situations, but if you don't have any measure that shows that this is an extreme situation, then you can't use that information as an extreme. So I would say you need to have some measure of what you're talking about to differentiate between these two. But you are right, sometimes anomalous things can teach you something interesting. Okay, so what kind of extremes are we talking about here? I don't know how I do with time, 1 second. Oh, plenty, okay. What kind of extremes are we talking about here? So this is just a picture of a black hole. For example, again, we can talk about the highest densities. Black holes will be useful to measure things. At extreme densities, again, stellar mass black holes are extremely dense, and they are formed usually, their birth involves compressing matter to extremely high densities. So this is usually useful in the first place, but also matter accreting onto the black hole will reach extreme densities. So by studying this, by studying the emission from this matter accreting onto the black hole, we can go to the extreme in densities. Magnetic fields may be less familiar, but basically, when these little particles fall into the black hole, when this dense material forms here, it's going to be mostly charged, little charged particles, and they're going to be extremely strong magnetic fields that basically are a result of the motion of little charged particles in this dense medium here. And there's going to be this extremely strong magnetic field, just like around the Earth. There's going to be extremely strong magnetic fields around black holes as well. Again, not because of the black hole, but because of their surrounding. And we can study what happens with these extremely strong magnetic fields by studying the black holes and studying what's coming out of their surroundings. Temperatures. Of course, as we get closer, as matter accretes onto the black hole, we're going to have these extremely high temperatures that are otherwise unprecedented. And we can study how matter behaves at these extremely high temperatures by studying what happens near black holes. Again, we have a measure of what we're talking about, and then we study what the consequences are of having this extreme situation. Getting a little farther and seeing this, the black hole is there now, seeing this this outflow, this energetic outflow, that can also teach us things. For example, these jets, these extremely energetic outflows, will accelerate little particles to very, very high velocities and energies. So gamma rays that we observe, the photons are also very energetic, but there's going to be other particles that are coming out of here that are very energetic. How many of you have heard of these things called cosmic rays? Okay, that's fairly good. So cosmic rays are basically extremely energetic, any kind of particles, but mainly protons or sometimes heavier elements that are accelerated by a currently unknown source. And there can be energetic much more than, for example, what we can obtain here on Earth with particle colliders. The highest energy cosmic rays are much more energetic than particle colliders. And let me get back to one of the previous questions about connections between the Higgs boson and gravitational waves. So I don't know if you guys heard, there was an issue with the particle colliders this time and the previous times too, that somebody, I think from Hawaii, sued the detector because they suspected it's going to create tiny black holes that are going to eat the Earth and we're all going to die. Have you guys heard of this?
Yeah.
You have. Okay, so it didn't go through and the detector was completed, fortunately. And there are many ways to see whether this was a legitimate argument. And of course, none of us claims that we understand physics perfectly. So technically, one could claim that what if we just didn't take something into account? What if we just didn't think of some kind of process that will create these tiny black holes that'll eat us all? Now, the scientific argument first could be that, as you guys may know, tiny black holes actually radiate. They have a very high temperature, and they're going to just blow up by themselves. They're not going to live for long enough to eat anything. Okay, but what if we don't know something? What if we're just not aware of some physics? And the main argument why I felt safe even though this thing was built was cosmic rays. That whatever we produce here in this accelerator, whatever energies we accelerate particles to, that happens every minute in the atmosphere, all the time, right now. And the universe, maybe gamma ray bursts, accelerate these particles that crash into the Earth's atmosphere. And if this thing created a black hole, then we would have black holes created all the time in the atmosphere. And we're still alive, so this shouldn't be too dangerous. So this cannot be dangerous either. OK, so I hope you guys feel safer with this detector. But anyway, the point is, we don't really understand where these things, these very high energy cosmic rays come from, which again are the highest energy particles we've ever observed or we know of in the universe. But the chances are it's coming from some accretion mechanism around the black hole. We don't know which one. There could be the sources of gamma ray bursts, but there could be bigger black holes, supermassive black holes, that also accrete matter from their surrounding. We don't know which one is the source of these, but that's something that is very likely to be connected to some kind of black hole accretion process. So again, black holes help us learn about nature at the highest velocities and energies. So this is just a picture of a different kind of picture of the merger of two, let's say, black holes. We can also learn, again, from black holes about the strongest case of gravity, how gravity behaves in the strong field limit where it's extremely strong. And it may be different. Again, according to general relativity, according to our current understanding, it should behave in a way that we understand with our current models. But if there's any deviation that, again, could give us a hint on how to connect the Thanon model of particle physics with gravity. That could come from understanding how gravity behaves at its extreme at the highest fields. Okay, so this is something that, again, will hopefully be addressed by detecting gravitational waves from these sources. And again, just zooming out a little more, this is the universe forever. So this is the Big Bang at the beginning. Maybe you guys have seen this picture before. There is this inflation when the whole thing expands very fast, and then you have galaxy formation, and then you end up with today's universe. So there's a bunch of things on this picture. But basically, black holes can help us study the universe. Again, this is time, this is space, can study the universe at very large distances from us, very far back in time also. For example, the brightest sources we see in the universe from many, many billions of years ago, many, many billions of light years away, are black holes, basically supermassive black holes accreting. So we can see to the farthest with some kind of black hole accretion. Also, if you take mergers of black holes, stellar mass or bigger black holes, again, supermassive black holes can merge too. These things can provide this standard brightness sources. So if this happens anywhere in the universe that we can detect, we will know exactly how far it happened based on how strong this source is, and we can calibrate how the universe expanded in time. Okay, so that's something that we don't completely understand now, and we're learning about. Again, there's an expansion, there's an accelerated expansion, as was discovered 10 years ago, but there's many open questions about this, and by detecting black hole mergers, we could have a much better understanding of how this expansion happened in time. Okay, so again, black holes themselves can tell us about large distances. And of course, the distant path too, basically the formation of the earliest stars and the death of the earliest stars, and the formation of the first galaxies, the earliest galaxies, may be inferred from detecting what kind of black holes are out there in the universe, in our galaxy. Okay, so by learning about the black hole population around us in the universe, we can learn about the very distant path when galaxies and the first stars were formed. Very nice. So I'll jump to the last topic, which is I wanted to mention a specific example, research example that we conducted not too long ago that is connected to a bunch of these things that we talked about. And this is connected to a gas cloud that was discovered a few years ago, I think maybe 2 years ago, going towards the center of our galaxy, towards the very center of the Milky Way, where, as we know, there is a ginormous black hole. So this is a rare event in the first place. Let me just jump to, this is a rare event because things usually happen on a much longer time frame in astrophysics. You usually talk about millions of years or even longer, except for these few events, which are explosions. But something approaching an interesting spot, let's say the galactic center, over a period of a year or so, that's something extremely rare in astrophysics. So that's a unique opportunity. And I wanted to use this, chance for an advertisement, which is, I don't know if you guys have heard of Stuart Firestein. He's a professor here at Columbia. And he has this book called Ignorance on scientific research, how scientists think. And it's a very honest way to describe research or describe scientists, which is basically that we are mostly interested in what we don't know. We don't care about what we know already. That's just a matter of necessity. We only care about what's out there, what we don't know. And that's what we're going to talk about. That's what we're going to find. And that's the point of our research. It's more like a selfish way of looking at things, if you will. And in a certain way, this is what happens here. We have this gas cloud, this name G2. It's a very interesting name. Basically, again, it was discovered 2 years ago that there is this huge gas cloud, which is roughly the size of the solar system. It's a very big gas cloud for, again, for our standards in the galaxy. It's not that big, of course. But its mass is only three times the mass of the Earth. Okay, so it's a very sparse gas cloud, although gas in general in the galactic center is much, much more sparse. So this is actually very dense compared to the region in the center of our galaxy. And it turns out that this thing, this gas cloud, is approaching the galactic center, which you can or cannot see somewhere here. And it's going to basically get the closest to the galactic center right about now or in the next few months, basically. So it's a very actual thing. And it is actually interesting because we know so little about the galactic center. We know that there's a black hole. We know that there it must be accreting. We know about other black holes that are so massive. But otherwise, there's a lot of open questions about how things behave at this region in space. And again, we can understand this much better, the galactic center much better than supermassive black holes at any other galaxy, because this is way closer than any other galaxy we know of. So studying this can tell us a lot about what happens at other galaxies as well. But again, what I want to emphasize here, there are lots of open questions, and we know surprisingly little how things behave, for example, how black holes accrete, how these supermassive black holes accrete in details. So this gas cloud that's, again, happening basically right now gave us a very interesting opportunity to study what happens when a supermassive black hole eats a gas cloud or a part of a gas cloud. This is going to be at least partly eaten, or it's being eaten right now. Very sad. So the question is, again, just referring back to the book of Professor Feierstein, how can we use this gas cloud for our purposes? It's, you know, there are many open questions, obviously, but what kind of astrophysical measurements are interesting with regard to this gas cloud? Okay, so that's a different way of thinking, which is finding interesting questions is a part of the scientific process. So I just want to get back again. My major research area is connected to gravitational waves. So let me just remind you again to some gravitational wave sources. First of all, one of the most interesting sources is when two compact objects, let's say two black holes, merge together. It's usually a rotation that two black holes rotate around each other, and eventually, through the radiation of gravitational waves, they get closer and closer and merge into one bigger black hole. Okay, that's the usual way. But what also can happen technically is if two lonely black holes get near enough to each other that they get gravitationally bound through the radiation of gravitational waves, they can become a couple and stay together for ever after. But again, they need to get close enough to each other, which is rare astrophysically, because again, there are these humongous distances between any two objects. So again, this is something rare. Another interesting aspect that I'll mention in a second is this intermediate mass black holes that I mentioned that we don't know about, and there's no confirmation that we can even think of to detect these things. Again, many other objects can produce similar signatures as these black holes. So the only way how we will be able to see these things is if something falls into them and we detect the gravitational wave signature of this info. So that's something that also is going to be very interesting in the near future. The problem with this, especially with the encounter of two black holes nearby, that these things are extremely rare. If things are far away, they're never going to meet. They're never going to merge together. We're never going to see these events. So finding a place where these things happen more often, or more dense regions where there's more black holes, is extremely interesting to understand. And it turns out that one interesting region where we can have a larger population of black holes is in the center of every galaxy. It turns out, interestingly, that black holes, again, it's not just stars like to be in couples, black holes like to be in groups. If there is a population of black holes in the galaxy, again, stars die all the time, they form black holes, and these black holes wander around in the galaxy. But eventually, or slowly, these black holes like to move towards the galactic center. They like to congregate in the galactic center. They don't like to be by themselves far away. They want to come to the very center. And we're going to end up, supposedly, a density cusp of black holes, a large population of facets of black holes, let's say, at the very vicinity of the central supermassive black holes. All these other black holes are going to be much smaller, but they're all going to move towards the very center where we're going to have this huge population. So the question is, can we use G2, this gas cloud, to say something about this large black hole population? Again, there are different ways to detect black holes, but it's more the exception than the rule. Most black holes are unseen. We don't see many of the black holes here. So we don't know much about this black hole population in the galactic center. And maybe G2, this gas cloud, can give us a tool to say something about what happens with this population, again, close to the galactic center. So what do we need to understand better to tell whether we can actually use this cloud to say something about the black hole population? First of all, is the size of G2, is the size and the density of the black holes enough such that this gas cloud will actually encounter any of the black holes. We did the calculation. It turns out that as the gas cloud gets really close to the galactic center, the population of black holes is going to be dense enough that the chances are that it's going to actually encounter many black holes, let's say 10 black holes at least. So these encounters will actually happen, again, given our understanding of how dense this black hole population should be in the center. So far, so good. This can actually result in an encounter that we can then detect. So the next question is, will this encounter between these two objects be detectable? It's one thing that this is a gas cloud. It's one thing that the black hole encounters this or goes into this gas cloud. But will this be actually something that's observable? Again, if there's some strong accretion, we know that we can see those black holes. We can see some black holes. But we don't know for this density specifically that it's going to be accreting enough matter that it's going to be visible to us. And well, first of all, there's a crossing time of 1 month, which is important for observation. If you want to tell a satellite to look at this direction, look at G2's direction, and observe if there's any encounter, then having an encounter of 1 month is very useful because we don't need to be there right on time. We can be a little off or a little late. And if we do the calculations, if we look at how much accretion will happen, how much matter the black hole will eat as it gets into this gas cloud, it turns out that some of these encounters may be detectable actually with X-rays. I don't know if I forgot your first question, but it was X-rays. I'm not sure if I answered that, but X-rays. So we can actually see these encounters, or some of these encounters, with X-rays, which are, X-rays actually are, that's what you have at your doctor, but it's also energetic photons that are very energetic, but not as energetic as gamma rays, a little less energetic, but somewhere there. So the next thing is to contact the satellites and make these observations. Again, the encounter when G2 gets to the closest to the galactic center is about now or the next half a year. So these observations are going to be extremely valuable in the next half a year when we make these. So let me just summarize very quickly, and then we can have more questions. So the takeaway message, what I wanted to emphasize here through these examples, is that black holes, we hear a lot of things about black holes, but it's not this intellectual curiosity or science fiction that I think the most interesting about black holes, but actually the fact that we can use them as astrophysical tools to learn about the universe in many different ways. Thank you.